sinister N. Ripoff himself. Bullshit. Chicharny is already dead. Didn't you hear? He's been dead for months. They've had somebody impersonating him till all the others in his block are taken care of. No, he came into Lüneburg last weekend. My mate's seen him before. No mistake, it's him. He's lost a lot of weight and takes a heavy bodyguard everywhere he goes. At least a dozen. Orientals, mostly. Fully equipped with Judas Iscariot, no doubt. That one's hard to believe. A dozen? Where does anybody find that many people he can trust? Especially out at the edge like he is. What edge? They're rattling along in the back of a 2.5-ton lorry through green, rolling country. A storm is blowing up mute purple, veined in yellow, behind them. Haley's been drinking wine with the scurvy lot of Tommies, a demolition squad who've been out all day clearing canals. They smell of creosote, marsh mud, ammonia from the dynamite. Well, you know what he's doing. The rockets? I wouldn't want to be in his place, that's all. Up on the crest of a hill, an army surveying party is restoring a damaged road. One silhouette leans, peering through a transit. One holds the bob. A bit apart from the instrument man, another engineer stands with his arms out straight to the sides. His head moves, sighting along either pointed land, then the arms swoop together. If you close your eyes and have learned to let your arms move by themselves, your fingers will touch, making a perfect right angle from where they were. Gailey watches the tiny act. It is devotional, graceful, and she feels the cross the man has made on his own circle of visible earth, unconsciously a mandala. It is a sign for her. He is pointing her on her way. Later that evening, she sees an eagle flying across the marshes in the same direction. It's golden dark, almost night. The region is lonely, and Pan is very close. Gailey has been to enough Sabbaths to handle it, she thinks. But what is a devil's blue bite on the ass to the shrieking outward into stone resonance where there is no good or evil out in the luminous spaces Pan will carry her to? Is she ready yet for anything so real? The moon has risen. She sits now at the same spot where she saw the eagle, waiting, waiting for something to come and take her. Have you ever waited for it, wondering whether it will come from outside or inside? Finally past the futile guesses at what might happen, now and then re-erasing brain to keep it clean for the visit. Yes, wasn't it close to here? Remember, didn't you sneak away from camp to have a moment alone with what you felt stirring across the land? It was the equinox. Green spring equal nights. Canyons are opening up. At the bottoms are steaming fumaroles, steaming the tropical life there like greens in a pot, rank dope perfume, a hood of smell. Human consciousness, that poor cripple, that deformed and doomed thing is about to be born. This is the world just before men. Too violently pitched, alive, in constant flow, ever to be seen by men directly. They are meant only to look at it dead, in still strata, transputrefied to oil or coal. Alive, it was a threat. It was Titans. Was an overpeaking of life so clangorous and mad, such a green corona about Earth's body that some spoiler had to be brought in before it blew the creation apart. So we, the crippled keepers, were sent out to multiply, to have dominion. God's spoilers. Us. Counter-revolutionaries. It is our mission to promote death. The way we kill, the way we die, being unique among the creatures. It was something we had to work on, historically and personally, to build from scratch up to its present status as reaction, nearly as strong as life, holding down the green uprising, but only nearly as strong, only nearly because of the defection rate. A few keep going over to the Titans every day in their striving sub-creation. How can flesh tumble and flow so and never be any less beautiful? Into the rests of the folk song, death, empty stone rooms, out and through and down under the net, down to the uprising. In harsh-edged echo, Titans stir far below. They are all the presences we are not supposed to be seeing. Wind gods, hilltop gods, sunset gods, that we train ourselves away from to keep from looking further even though enough of us do, leave their electric voices behind in the twilight at the edge of the town and move into the constantly parted cloak of our night walk till suddenly Pan, leaping, its face too beautiful to bear, beautiful serpent, its coils in rainbow lashings in the sky, into the sure bones of fright. Don't walk home at night through the empty country. Don't go into the forest when the light is too low, even too late in the afternoon. It will get you. Don't sit by the tree like this with your cheek against the bark. It is impossible in this moonlight to see if you are male or female now. Your hair spills silver white. Your body under the gray cloth is so exactly vulnerable, so fated to degradation time and again. What if he wakes and finds you've gone? He is now always the same, awake or asleep. He never leaves the single dream. There are no more differences between the worlds. They have become one for him. Tanats and Margarita may have been his last ties with the old. That may be why they stayed so long. It was his desperation. He wanted to hold on. He needed them. But when he looks at them now, he doesn't see them as often anymore. They are also losing what reality they brought here, as Gottfried lost all of his to Blissero long ago. Now the boy moves image to image, room to room, sometimes out of the action, sometimes part of it. Whatever he has to do, he does. The day has its logic, its needs. No way for him to change it, leave it, or live outside it. He is helpless. He is sheltered, secure. It's only a matter of weeks and everything will be over. Germany will have lost the war. The routines go on. The boy cannot imagine anything past the last surrender. If he and Blissero are separated, what will happen to the flow of days? Will Blissero die? No, please don't let him die. But he will. "You're going to survive me," he whispers. Gottfried kneels at his feet, wearing the dog collar. Both are in army clothes. It's a long time since either of them dressed as a woman. It is important tonight that they both be men. "Ah, you're so smug, you little bastard." "It is only another game, isn't it? Another excuse for a whipping?" Gottfried keeps silent. When Blissero wants an answer, he says so. It happens often that he only wants to talk, and that may go on for hours. No one has ever talked to Gottfried before, not like this. His father uttered only commands, sentences, flat judgments. His mother was emotional, a great flow of love. Frustration and secret terror passed into him from her, but they never really talked. This is so more than real. He feels he must keep every word, that none must be lost. Blissero's words have become precious to him. He understands that Blissero wants to give without expecting anything back, give away what he loves. He believes that he exists for Blissero, even if the others have all ceased to. That in the new kingdom they pass through now, he is the only other living inhabitant. Was it this he expected to be taken by, taken into? Blissero's seed sputtering into the poisoned manure of his bowels. It is waste, yes, futility, but as man and woman, coupled, are shaken to the teeth at their approaches to the gates of life, hasn't he also felt more, worshipfully more, past these arrangements for penetration, the style, garments of flaying without passion, sheer hosiery perishable as the skin of a snake, custom manacles and chains to stand for the bondage he feels in his heart. All become theater as he approached the gates of that other kingdom, felt the white gigantic muzzles somewhere inside, expressionless beasts frozen white, pushing him away, the crust and mantle hum of mystery so beyond his poor hearing. There have to be these two. Lovers whose genitals are consecrated to shit, to endings, to the desperate nights in the streets when connection proceeds out of all personal control, proceeds or fails, a gathering of fallen, as many in acts of death as in acts of life, or a sentence to be alone for another night. Are they to be denied, passed over, all of them? On his approaches to it, taken inward again and again, Gottfried can only try to keep himself open, to loosen the sphincter of his soul. and sometimes I dream of discovering the edge of the world, finding that there is an end. My mountain gentian always knew, but it has cost me so much. America was the edge of the world, a message for Europe, continent-sized, inescapable. Europe had found the site for its kingdom of death, that special death the West had invented. Savages had their waste regions, Kalaharis, lakes so misty they could not see the other side, but Europe had gone deeper, into obsession, addiction, away from all the savage innocences. America was a gift from the invisible power, the way of returning, but Europe refused it. It wasn't Europe's original sin. The latest name for that is modern analysis, but it happens that subsequent sin is harder to atone for. In Africa, Asia, Amerindia, Oceania, Europe came and established its order of analysis and death. But it could not use it killed or altered. In time, the death colonies grew strong enough to break away, but the impulse to empire, the mission to propagate death, the structure of it, kept on. Now we are in the last phase. American death has come to occupy Europe. It has learned empire from its old metropolis, but now we have only the structure left us. None of the great rainbow plumes, no fittings of gold, no epic marches over alkali seas. The savages of other continents, corrupted but still resisting in the name of life, have gone on despite everything, while death and Europe are separate as ever, their love still unconsummated. Death only rules here. It has never, in love, become one with. Is the cycle over now and a new one ready to begin? Will our new edge, our new death kingdom, be the moon? I dream of a great glass sphere, hollow and very high and far away. The colonists have learned to do without air, its vacuum inside and out. It's understood the men won't ever return. They are all men. There are ways for getting back, but so complicated, so at the mercy of language, that presence back on Earth is only temporary and never real. Passages out there are dangerous, chances of falling so shining and deep. Gravity rules all the way out to the cold sphere. There is always the danger of falling. Inside the colony, the handful of men have a frosty appearance, hardly solid, no more alive than memories, nothing to touch, only their remote images, black and white film images, grained, broken year after hoarfrost year out in the white latitudes, in empty colony, with only infrequent visits from the accidental, like me. I wish I could recover it all. Those men had once been through a tragic day, ascent, fire, failure, blood. The events of that day so long ago had put them into exile forever. No, they weren't really spacemen. Out here, they wanted to dive between the worlds, to fall, turn, reach, and swing on journeys curved through the shining, through the winter nights of space. Their dreams were of rendezvous, of cosmic trapeze acts, carried on in loneliness, in sterile grace, in certain knowledge that no one would ever be watching, that loved ones had been lost forever. The connections they hoped for would always miss by trillions of dark miles, by years of frozen silence. But I wanted to bring you back the story. I remember that you used to whisper me to sleep with stories of us one day living on the moon. Are you beyond that by now? You've got much older. Can you feel in your body how strongly I have infected you with my dying? I was meant to. When a certain time has come, I think that we are all meant to. Fathers are carriers of the virus of death. And sons are the infected. And, so that the infection may be more certain, death in its ingenuity has contrived to make the father and son beautiful to each other as life has made male and female. Oh, Gottfried, of course, yes, you are beautiful to me, but I'm dying. I want to get through it as honestly as I can, and your immortality rips at my heart. Can't you see why I might want to destroy that, oh, that stupid clarity in your eyes when I see you in morning and evening ranks, so open, so ready to take my sickness in and shelter it inside your own little ignorant love? Your love. He nods several times. But his eyes are too dangerously spaced beyond the words stunned irreversibly away from real Gottfried, away from the weak, the failed smells of real breath, by barriers stern and clear as ice, and hopeless as the one-way flow of European time. I want to break out, to leave this cycle of infection and death. I want to be taken in love, so taken that you and I and death and life will be gathered inseparable into the radiance of what we would become. Gottfried kneels, numb, waiting. Glycero is looking at him, deeply, his face whiter than the boy has ever seen it. A raw spring wind beats the canvas of their tent. It's near sunset. In a moment, Glycero must go out to take evening reports. His hands rest near a mound of cigarette butts in a mess tray. His myopic witch's eyes, through the thick lenses, may be looking into Gottfried's for the first time. Gottfried cannot look away. He knows, somehow, incompletely, that he has a decision to make, that Glycero expects something from him. But Glycero has always made the decisions. Why is he suddenly asking? It all poises here. Passageways of routine, still cogent enough, still herding us through time. The iron rockets waiting outside. The birth scream of the latest spring torn across rainy miles of Saxony. Root sides littered with last envelopes, stripped gears, seized bearings, rotted socks and skivvies fragrant now with fungus and mud. If there is still hope for Gottfried here in this wind-beat moment, then there is hope elsewhere. The scene itself must be read as a card. What is to come? Whatever has happened since to the figures in it, roughly drawn in soiled white, army gray, spare as a sketch on a ruined wall, it is preserved, though it has no name, and, like the fool, no agreed assignment in the deck. Here's Ensign ramrodding his brand-new rocket through the night. When it rains, when the mist is heavy, before the watch can quite get tarps over, the glossy skin of the rocket is seen to have turned to dark slate. Perhaps, after all, just before the firing, it will be painted black. It is the 00001, the second in its series. Russian loudspeakers across the Elbe have called to you. American rumors have come driving into the fires at night and summoned against the ground of your hopes, the yellow American deserts, red Indians, blue sky, green cactus. How did you feel about the old rocket? Not now that it's giving you job security, but back then. Do you remember any more what it was wheeling them out by hand, a dozen of you that morning, a guard of encounter of your bodies with its inertia? All your faces drowning in the same selfless look. The moires of personality softening, softening, each sweep of surf a little more out of focus till all has become subtle grades of cloud. All hatred, all love, wiped away for the short distance that could push it over the winter berm. Aging men in coat skirts flapping below your boot tops, breaths in white spouts breaking turbulent as the waves behind you. Where will you all go? What empires, what deserts? You caressed its body, brute, freezing through your gloves. Here together without shame or reticence, you 12 struggled in love on this Baltic shore. Not Peenemünde, perhaps, not official Peenemünde, but once, years ago, boys in white skirts and dark vests and caps, on some beach, a children's resort, when we were younger. At test stand 7, the image at last, you couldn't leave, the way the wind smelled salt and dying, the sound of winter surf, the premonition of rain you could feel at the back of your neck stirring in the clipped hairs. At test stand 7, the holy place. But young men have all grown older, and there's little color in the scene. They are pushing into the sun. The glare strikes them squinting and grinning. Bright here is the morning shift at Siemens with the centaurs struggling high on the wall. The clock without numerals. Bicycles squeaking. Lunch pails and lunch bags in the lowered faces of the trudging, dutiful streams of men and women into the dark openings. It resembles a daguerreotype taken of early Raketenstadt by a forgotten photographer in 1856. This is the picture, in fact, that killed him. He died a week later, from mercury poisoning after inhaling fumes of the heated metal in his studio. Well, he was a habitué of mercury fumes in moderate doses. He felt it did his brain some good, and that may account for pictures like Der Raketenstadt. It shows, from a height that is topographically impossible in Germany, the ceremonial city, fourfold as expected, an eerie precision to all lines and shadings, architectural and human, built in mandalic form like a Herero village. Overhead a magnificent sky, marble carried to a wildness of white billow and candescence. There seems to be building or demolition underway in various parts of the city, for nothing here remains the same. We can see the sweat in individual drops on the workers' dark necks as they struggle down the bone-damp cellars. A bag of cement has broken, and its separate motes hang in the light. The city will always be changing. New tire treads in the dust, new cigarette wrappers in the garbage. Engineering changes to the rocket create new routes of supply, new living arrangements, reflected in traffic densities as viewed from this unusual height. There are indeed tables of functions to get from such city changes to rocket modifications, no more than an extension, really, of the techniques by which Constance Babington Smith and her colleagues at RAF Medmenham discovered the rocket back in 1943 in Reco photographs of Peenemünde. But remember if you loved it. If you did, how you loved it. And how much. After all, you're used to asking how much, used to measuring, to comparing measurements, putting them into equations to find out how much more, how much of, how much when. And here, in your common drive to the sea, feel as much as you wish of that dark, double-minded love, which is also shame, bravado, engineers, geopolitics, spheres of influence, modified to toruses of rocket range that are parabolic in section. Not, as we might imagine, bounded below by the line of the earth it rises from and the earth it strikes. No, but then you never really thought it was, did you? Of course it begins infinitely below the earth and goes on infinitely back into the earth. It's only the peak that we are allowed to see. The breakup through the surface, out of the other silent world, violently. A jet airplane crashing into faster than sound. Some years later, a spaceship crashing into faster than light. Remember, the password in the zone this week is faster than the speed of light, speeding up your voice exponentially. Linear exceptions made only in case of upper respiratory complaints. At each end, understand, a very large transfer of energy, breaking upward into this world, a controlled burning, breaking downward again, an uncontrolled explosion. This lack of symmetry leads to speculating that a presence analogous to the ether flows through time, as the ether flows through space. The assumption of a vacuum in time tended to cut us off one from another, but an ether sea to bear us world to world might bring us back a continuity, show us a kinder universe, more easygoing. So, yes, yes, this is a scholasticism here, rocket state cosmology. The rocket does lead that way, among others, past these visible serpent coils that lash up above the surface of Earth in rainbow light, in steel tetany, these storms, these things of Earth's deep breast we were never told, past them through the violence to a numbered cosmos, a quaint brown wood-paneled Victorian kind of brain war, as between quaternions and vector analysis in the 1880s. The nostalgia of ether, the silver, pendulumed, stone-anchored, knurled, brass, filigreed, elegantly functional shapes of your grandfathers. These sepia tones are here, certainly, but the rocket has to be many things. It must answer to a number of different shapes in the dreams of those who touch it. In combat, in tunnel, on paper, it must survive heresies, shining, unconfoundable, and heretics there will be. Gnostics, who have been taken in a rush of wind and fire to chambers of the rocket throne. Kabbalists, who study the rocket as Torah, letter by letter, rivets, burner cap, and brass rose. Its text is theirs to permute and combine into new revelations, always unfolding. Manichaeans, who see two rockets, good and evil, who speak together in the sacred ideolalia of the primal twins. Some say their names are Enzian and Visero, of a good rocket to take us to the stars, an evil rocket for the world's suicide. The two perpetually in struggle. But these heretics will be sought, and the dominion of silence will enlarge as each one goes down. They will all be sought out. Each will have his personal rocket. Stored in its target seeker will be the heretic's EEG, the spikes and susurrations of heartbeat, the ghost blossomings of personal infrared. Each rocket will know its intended and hunt him, ride him a green, doped, and silent hound through our world, shining and pointed in the sky at his back, his guardian, executioner rushing in, rushing closer. Here are the objectives. To make the run over tracks that may end abruptly at Riverside or in carbonized train yard, over roads even the unpaved alternates to which are patrolled now by Russian and British and American troops in a hardening occupation. A fear of winter bleaching the men all more formal into braces of attention they ignored during the summer. Closer adherence now to the paperwork as colors of trees and brush begin their change, as purple blurs out over miles of heath and nights come sooner. To have to stay out in the rains of early Virgo, the children who stowed away on the trek against all orders are down now with coughs and fevers. Sniffling at night, hoarse little voices inside oversized uniform jackets. To brew tea for them from fennel, betony, wits and roses, sunflowers, mallow leaves. To loot sulfur drugs and penicillin. To avoid raising road dust when the sun has dried the ruts and crowns again by noon. To sleep in the fields. To hide the rocket sections under haystacks, behind the single wall of a gutted railroad shed, among rainy willows down beside the riverbeds. To disperse at any alarm, or often at random just for drill. To flow like a net, down out of the hearts, up the ravines, sleeping in the dry, glazed spaces of deserted spas. Official pain, official death watching all night from the porcelain eyes of statues. Digging its perimeters, smelling pine needles, boots, and trench shovels have crushed. To keep faith that it is not trek this time, nor struggle, but the destiny. 0001 sliding like an oiled bolt into the receivership of the railway system prepared for it last spring. A route only apparently in ruins, carefully crafted by the war by special techniques of bombardment to take this most immaculate of techniques, the rocket, this most terribly potential of bombardments. The 0001 goes disassembled in sections, warhead, guidance, fuel and oxidizer tanks, tail section. If they all make to the firing site, it will have to be put back together there. Show me the society that never said I am created among men. Christian walks with Enzian in the fields above the encampment, to protect you each from violence, to give shelter in time of disaster. But Enzian, what protection is there? What can protect us from that? Gesturing down the valley at the yellow-gray camouflage netting they can both, x-ray-eyed for this one journey, see through. Enzian and the younger man somehow have drifted into long walks, nothing deliberate on either side. Is this how successions occur? Each man is suspicious, but there are no more of the old uncomfortable silences, no competing. It comes as the revealer, showing that no society can protect, never could. They are as foolish as shields of paper. He must tell Christian everything he knows, everything he suspects or has dreamed, proclaiming none of it for truth. But he must keep nothing back for him. Nothing is his to keep. They have lied to us. They can't keep us from dying, so they lie to us about death. A cooperative structure of lies. What have they ever given us in return for the trust, the love? They actually say love we're supposed to owe them. Can they keep us from even catching cold? From lice, from being alone, from anything? Before the rocket we went on believing because we wanted to, but the rocket can penetrate from the sky at any given point. Nowhere is safe. We can't believe them anymore, not if we are still sane and love the truth. We are, nods Christian. We do. He isn't looking at any confirm it either. Yes. than in the absence of faith. One night, in the rain, their lager stops for the night at a deserted research station where the Germans, close to the end of the war, were developing a sonic death mirror. Tall paraboloids of concrete staggered, white and monolithic, across the plain. The idea was to set off an explosion in front of the paraboloid at the exact focal point. The concrete mirror would then throw back a perfect shock wave to destroy anything in its path. Thousands of guinea pigs, dogs, and cows were experimentally blasted to death here. Reams of death-curve data were compiled. But the project was a lemon, only good at short range, and you rapidly aim to a fall-off point where the amount of explosives well be deployed some other way. Fog, wind, hardly visible ripples or snags in the terrain, anything less than perfect conditions, could ruin the shockwave's deadly shape. Still, Enzian can envision a war, a place for them, a desert. Lure your enemy to a desert, Tlahari, wait for the wind to die. Who would fight for a desert? Katya wants to know. She's wearing a hooded green slicker, looks even too big for Enzian. In, Christian, jotting down, looking up at the pale curve of reflector they've come to the base of and have gathered at in the rain, sharing a smoke, taking a moment away from the rest of the trek. What he's saying is in. Saves trouble later if you can get the texts straight soon as they're spoken. Thank you, says Oberst Enzian. 100 meters away, a gray tanker jacket. Out of its pocket, eyes. It is fat lemming Ursula. For all and despite everything, drifting alongside the trek, just past visibility, among trees at the tops of escarpments, at the fire's edges at night, Ludwig is there, watching. Accumulating evidence, or terms of an equation. A boy and his lemming, out to sea alone. Mostly what he's seen is a lot of chewing gum and a lot of foreign cock. How else does a footloose kid get by in the zone these days? Ursula is preserved. Ludwig has fallen into it and death and found its nipple. So not all lemmings go over the cliff, and children are preserved against snuggling in of profit. To expect any more or less of the zone is to disagree with the terms of the creation. When Enzian rides point, he has the habit of falling into reveries, whether the driver is talking or not. In night, without force enough to be falling, or now and then blown like a wet silk scarf in the face, inside and outside the same temperature and darkness, balances like these allow him to float just under waking. Feet and arms bug upward, pushing at the rubbery glass tension between the two levels, sticking in it. Dream caressed at hands and feet become supersensitive, a good home-style, horizontal-less drowse. The engine of the stolen truck is muffled, old mattresses tied over the hood. Henrik the Hare, driving, keeps a leery eye on the temperature gauge. He's called the Hare because he can never get his right, as in the old Herero story. Severances are dying. A figure slips into the road, flashlight circling slowly. Enzian unsnaps the eye, leans out into the heavy mist and calls, faster than the speed of light. It fits him on. But in the last edge of Enzian's glance back, in the light from the flash, rain is sticking to the black face in big fat globules, sticking as water does to black grease paint, but not to Herero skin. We can make a U-turn here. The shoulders are treacherous, and both men know it. Back in the direction of camp, the line of slow-rolling lowlands is by a thud of apricot light. Shit! Henrik the Hare, jamming it in reverse, waiting for orders from Enzian as they grind slowly backwards. The one with the flashlight may have been the only lookout. There may be no enemy concentration for miles, but... There, beside the road, a prone body. It's Mieczysław Omuzire, head wound. Get him in, come on! They load him into the truck and cover him with a shelter half. No time to find out how bad it is. The black-faced sentry has vanished for good. From the direction they're backing in comes the stick rattle of rifle fire. We're going in mortar fire? Since the one? No. Andreas must have knocked it out then. Oh, they'll be all right in Guarareru. I'm worrying about us. Orutiene, dead. Ocandio, Ekori, Zire, wounded. Ekori critically. The hostiles were white. How many? A dozen, maybe. We can on a safe perimeter. Blue-white flashlight blobbing ellipse to parabola ux the shaking map. Till Braunschweig. It'll there. Wren hits the map in loud spatters. Where's the railroad? Puts in Christian. He gets an interested look from Andreas. It's mutual. There's a good deal of interest here lately. The railroad is 6 or 7 miles northwest. The people come, empty their belongings next to the rocket's trailer rigs. Saplings are being axed down, each blow loud and carrying. A frame is being constructed. Bundles of clothing, pots and kettles stuffed here and there under the long tarpaulin between bent sapling hoops to simulate pieces of rocket. S is calling, "All decoys by the cook wagon," fishing in his pockets for the list he keeps. The decoy trek will move on northward, no violent shift in direction. The rest will angle east, back toward the Russian army. If they get just close enough, the British-American armies may move more cautiously. It may be possible to ride the interface like gliding at the edge of a thunderstorm all the way to the end between armies east and west. Andreas sits dangling, feet kicking, heels against tailgate, bong, bong, tolling departure. Enzian looks up, quizzical. Andreas wants to say something. Finally, "Christian goes with you, then?" "Yes," blinking under rain-beaded eyebrows. "Oh, for God's sake, Andreas." "Well, the decoys are supposed to make it too, right? Look, take him with you if you want." "I wanted to find out," Andreas shrugs, "what's been settled." "You could have asked me. Nothing's been settled." "Maybe not by you. That's your game. You think it'll preserve you, but it doesn't work for us. We have to know what's really going to happen." Enzian kneels and begins to lift the heavy iron tailgate. He knows how phony it looks. Who will believe that in his heart he wants to belong to them out there, the vast humility, sleepless, dying, in pain tonight across the zone? The preterite he loves, knowing he's always to be a stranger. Chains rattle above him. The edge of the gate is level up into Andreas's eyes. His arms are braced tight. His elbows ache. It is an offering. He wants to ask, "How many others have written me off? Is there a thing I've been kept blind to?" But habits persist in their own life. He struggles to his feet, silently, lifting the dead weight, slamming it into place. Together they slip bolts through at each corner. "See you there," Enzian waves and turns away, swallows a tablet of German desoxyphedrine, then pops in a stick of gum. Speed makes teeth grind. Gum gets chewed by grinding teeth. Chewing on gum is a technique developed during the late war by women to keep from crying. Not that he wants to cry for the separation, he wants to cry for himself, for what they all must believe is going to happen to him. The more they believe it, the better chance there is. His people are going to demolish him if they can. Chomp, chomp. Good evening, ladies. Nice job on the lashings there, Lyubica. Chomp. How the head, Mieczyslav? Bet they were surprised when the bullets bounced off. Chomp, chomp. Evening, sparks. Ozohande. Anything from Hamburg yet on the liquid oxygen? Damned Oruru better come through-ru, or we gonna have a bad-ass time trying to lay low till he do-ru. Oh, shit, who's that? It's Josef Ombindis who it is, leader of the Empty Ones. But till he stopped smiling for a few seconds there, Enzian thought it was Orutiene's ghost. The word is that the Okandio child was killed, too. Not so, chump. It was my first try at preventing a birth. So you maintain a deadly interest in her. Chomp, chomp. He knows that's not it, but the man annoys him. Suicide is a freedom even the lowest enjoy, but you would deny that freedom to a people. No ideology. Tell me if your friend Aururu is going to have the LOX generator ready to roll, or if there is a funny surprise instead waiting for me in Hamburg. All right, no ideology. You would deny your even you enjoy, Oberst Nguarareru. Smiling again like the ghost of the man who fell tonight. Probing for the spot, jabbing what, what? Want to say what, Oberst, till he sees the tiredness in Enzian's face and understands it is not a trick. A freedom, whispering, smiling, a love song under black skies edged all around in acid orange, a commercial full of Cather horror at the practice of imprisoned of newborns. A freedom you may exercise soon. I hear your soul talking in its sleep. I know you better than anyone. Chomp, chomp. Oh, I had to give him the watch lists, didn't I? Oh, am I fool? Yes, he can choose the... You're a hallucination, Ombindi. Putting just enough pep to his voice so that if it doesn't work, it'll still be a good insult. I'm projecting my own death wish, and it comes out looking like you. Uglier than I ever dreamed. Giving him the spaceman smile for a full 30 seconds, after only 10 seconds of which Ombindi has already begun to shift his eyes, sweat, press his lips together, look at the ground, turn away, look back, but Enzian prolongs it, No mercy tonight, my people. Spaceman smiled, turning everything inside a radius to frozen ice cream colors. Now that we're all in the mood, how about in the battery covers anyway, Juro? That's right, X-ray vision. Saw right the tarp. Write it down as another miracle. You there, Vlasta, take the next radio watch. Forget what it says on the list. There's never been any more than routine traffic logged with Hamburg, and I want to know why. Want to know what does come when Umbindi's people are on watch. Communication on the command frequency is by serial dots and dashes. No voices to betray. But operators swear they can tell the individual sending hands. Vlasta is one of the best operators, and she can do good hand imitations of most of Umbindi's people. Been practicing up just in case. The others, who've been all along wondering if Enzian was ever going to move on Umbindi, can tell now by the look on his face and the way he's walking through. So, with little more than touches to the brim of his forage cap, signaling plan so-and-so, the Umbindi people are quiet without violence, relieved of all watch duties tonight, though still keeping their weapons and ammo. No one has ever taken those away. There's no reason to. Enzian is no more vulnerable now than he ever was, which was plenty. The fat boy Ludwig is a white glowworm in the mist. The game is that he's scouting for a vast white army, always at his other flank, ready to come down off of the high ground at a word from Ludwig and smear the blacks into the earth. But he would never call them down. He would rather go with the trek, invisible. There is no hustling for him down there. Their journey doesn't include him. They have somewhere to go. He feels he must go with them, but separate, a stranger. No more or less at the mercy of the zone. Bridge over a stream. Very seldom will traffic come by overhead. You can look up and see a whole slope of cone-bearing trees rushing up darkly away from one of the road. Trees creak in sorrow for the engineered wound through their terrain, their terrenity or earthhood. Trout flick by in the stream. Inside the culvert, other shelterers have written on the damp arc of wall, "Take me, Stretchfoot, what keeps you? Nothing worse than these. You will be like gentle sleep. Isn't it only sleep? Please, come soon." Private Rudolf Effig, 12-4-45. A drawing of Mando Blackface Grease, a man looking closely at a flower. In the distance, or smaller, appears to be a woman approaching, or some kind of elf, or something. The man isn't looking at her, or it. In the middle distance are haystacks. The flower is shaped like the cunt of a young girl. There is a luminary looking down from the sky, a face on it totally at peace, like the Buddha's. Underneath, someone else has written in English, "Drawing, finish." And underneath that, in another hand, "It is finished, you nit, and so are you." Nearby in German, "I love you, Lisele, with all my heart." No name, rank, unit, or serial number. Initials, tic-tac-toe games you can tell were played alone, a game of hangman in which the missed word was never filled in, G-E-blank-blank-R-A-T-blank-blank, and the hanged body visible almost at the other end of the culvert, even this in the day, because it's a narrow road and no real gradient of shadow. A bicycle is incompletely hidden in the weeds at the side of the road. A late butterfly, pale as an eyelid, winks aimlessly out over the stalks of new hay. High up on the slope, someone is swinging an axe blade into a living tree, and here is where and when the young witch finds Václav Cicerny at last. He's sitting by the stream, not dejected nor tranquil, just waiting. A passive solenoid waiting to be sprung. At her step, his head lifts, and he sees her. She is the first presence since last night he's looked at and seen, which is her doing. The charm she recited then, fastening the silk crotch torn from her best underpants across the eyes of the doll, his eyes, eastern and liquid, though they'd been only sketched in clay with her long fingernail, was this: "May he be blind now to all but me. May the burning sun of love shine in his eyes forever. May this, my own darkness, shelter him. By all the holy names of God, by the angels Melchidael, Yahoel, Anaphiel, and the great Metatron, I conjure you and all who are with you to go and do my will." The secret is in the concentrating. She inhibits everything else, the moon and the junipers, the wild dogs out ranging in the middle of the night. She fixes on Cicerny's memory and his wayward eyes and lets it be basing her orgasm to the incantation, so that by the end, naming the last names of power, she's screaming, coming, without help, from her fingers which are raised to the sky. Later, she breaks a piece of the magic bread in half and eats one part. The other is for Ticherini. He takes the bread now. The stream rushes. A bird sings. Toward nightfall, the lovers, lying naked on a cold grass, sound of a convoy approaches on the little road. Ticherini pulls on his trousers and climbs up to see if he can beg some food or cigarettes. The black faces pass by. Mbakayere. Some glancing at him curiously, others too involved with their own exhaustion or with keeping a tight guard on a covered wagon containing the warhead section of the 00001. Ancien on his motorcycle stops for a moment, Mbakayere, the tarred, unshaven white. They're in the middle of the bridge. They talk broken German. Ticherini managed to hustle half a pack of American cigarettes and three raw potatoes. The two nod, not quite formally, not quite smiling. Ancien puts his bike in gear and return journey. Ticherini lights a cigarette, watching them down the road, shivering in the dusk. Then he goes back to his young girl beside the sun. They will have to locate some firewood before all is gone. This is magic, sure, but not necessarily fantasy. Certainly not the first time a man has passed his brother by, at the edge of the evening, often forever, without knowing it. By now the city has grown so tall that elevators are long halls with lounges inside, padded seats and benches, snack bars, newsstands where you can browse through a whole issue of life between stops. For those faint hearts who first thing on entering certificate of inspection on the elevator wall, there are young women in green overseas caps, green velvet basques, and tapered yellow striped trousers, a feminine zoot suit effect, who've been tutored in all kinds of elevator lore, and whose job it is to set you at ease. In the early days, pipes young Mindy Bloth of Carbon City, Illinois, smiling vacantly away in profile, close by the brass moire of diamond blurs, passing in vertical thousands, her growing-up face, dreamy and practical as the Queen of Cups, quite looks for you, is always refracted away some set angle in the gold-brown medium between you. It's morning, and the flower man at the rear of the elevator, down a step or two behind the little fountain, has brought lilacs and irises fresh and early. Before the vertical solution, all transport was, in effect, two-dimensional. I can guess your question, as a smile, familiar and unrefracted, for this old elevator regular passes between girl and heckler. What about airplane flight? That's what you were going to ask, wasn't it? As a matter of fact, he was going to ask about the rocket, and everyone knows it, but the subject is under a curious taboo, and polite Mindy has brought in now a chance for actual violence, the violence of repression, the bleached colors of a September morning sky opposite the sunrise, and the filing edge of a morning wind in this intimate cubic environment moving so smoothly upward through space, a bubble rising through Castile soap where all around it's green lit by slow lightning. Past levels already a bustle with heads seething brighter than sperm and eggs in the sea. Past some levels left dark, unheated, somehow forbidden, looking oddly wasted. Levels where nobody's been since the war. Ah, howling past. A common aerodynamic effect, explains patient Mindy. Involving our own boundary layer and the shape of the orifice as we pass it. Oh, you mean that before we get to it? Hollers another heckler. It's a different shape. Yup, and after we go by it, too, Mac, Mindy brushes him off, oddly mugging the same thing with her mouth. Purse relaxed smile, these jagged openings howling, hauling forlorn and downward, already stories gone beneath the soles of your shoes, a howl bent downward like a harmonica note. But why don't any of the busy floors make a sound going by? Where the lights are shining warm as Christmas week parties, floors that beckon you into densities of glass faceting or screening, good-natured coffee-urn grousing, well, golly, here goes another day. Howdy, Marie, were you ladies hiding the drawings? Who won? What do you mean food service has them again? Doesn't engineering design have any rights? It's like watching your child run away to see a piece of equipment set out to the field. Their welt, that it is. A broken heart, a mother's prayer. Slowly the voices of the Lübeck Hitler Youth Glee Club fade in behind. Nowadays the boys sing at officers' clubs all across the zone under their road name, the Lederhoseners, addressed appropriately and sing, when the house feels right, with their backs turned to the orders, their sly little faces turned over shoulders to flirt with the fighting men. But sharper than a mother's are the beatings Mutti gave to me. with a beautifully coordinated then to each pair of buttocks, gleaming through leather so tight that the clenching of gluteal muscles is plainly visible, and you can bet there isn't a cock in the room doesn't stir at a sight, and scarcely an eye that can't hallucinate that maternal mass, the delicious red lines, the stern and beautiful female face smiling down through lowered lashes, only a glint of light off of each eye. When you were first learning to crawl, it was her calves and feet you saw the most of. They replaced her breasts as sources of strength. As you learned the smell of her leather shoes, the sovereign smell rose as far as you could see, to her knees perhaps, depending on fashion that year, to her thighs. You were infant in the presence of leather legs, leather feet. It's whispers that we all learned that classical fantasy at mother's knees, that sir tucked in the brain's plush album is always a child in Fauntleroy's, a pretty French maid begging to be whipped. Ludwig shifts his rather fat ass under Tanatz's hand. Both have perimpos to cross, but they have crept away anyhow, to a piece of the interface, a cold thicket they've pound a space in the middle of to lie on. Ludwig, a little S&M hurt anybody.
Who said that?
Sigmund Freud. But why are we taught to feel reflexive shame whenever it comes up? Why will the structure allow every other kind of sexual behavior but that one? Because submission and dominance are resources it needs for its very survival. They cannot be wasted in private sex, in any kind of sex. It needs ours so that they remain in power. It needs our lusts after dominance so that it can co-opt us into its own power. There is no joy in it, only power. I tell you, if S&M could be established universally, at the family level, the state would wither. This is sado-anarchism, and Penatz is its leading theoretician in the zone these days. It is the Lüneburg Heath at last. Brand was made last night with the grooming fuel and oxidizer tanks. The tail section group has been on the radio all morning trying to get a position fix if the sky is clear. So the assembly of the 00001 is occurring also in a geographical way, a diaspora running backwards, seeds of exile flying inward in a modest view of gravitational collapse, of the Messiah gather fallen sparks. Remember the story about the kid who hates Kreplach? Hates and fears the dish, breaks out in these horrible green hives that shift in relief across his body in the mere presence of Kreplach? Kid's mother takes him to the psychiatrist. Fear of the unknown, diagnoses this gray eminence. Let him watch you making the Kreplach. That'll ease him into home to mother's kitchen. Now, says mother, I'm going to make us a delicious surprise. Oh, boy, cries the kid. That's keen, Mom. See, now I'm sifting the flour and salt into a nice little pile. Hamburger? Oh, boy. Hamburger and onions. I'm frying them here, see, in this frying pan. Gee, I can hardly wait. This is exciting. What are you doing now? Making a little volcano in the flour here and breaking these eggs into it. Can I help you mix it up? Oh, boy. Now I'm going to roll the dough out, see, into a nice flat sheet. Now I'm cutting it up into squares. This is terrific, Mom. Now I spoon some of the hamburger into this little square, and now I fold it over into a... Gah! Screams the kid in absolute terror. Kreplach! End of side 23. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 24. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Fincham. Continuing on page 860. As some secrets were given to the gypsies to preserve against centrifugal history, and some to the Kabbalists, the Templars, the Rosicrucians, so have this secret of the fearful assembly and others found their ways inside the weatherless spaces of this or that ethnic joke. There is also the story about Peron Slothrop, who was sent into the zone to be present as his own assembly. Perhaps heavily paranoid voices have whispered, his time's assembly, and there ought to be a punchline to it, but there isn't. The plan went wrong. He is being broken down instead and scattered. His cards have been laid down, Celtic style, in the order suggested by Mr. A. E. Waite, laid out and read, but they are the cards of a tanker and Phoebe. They point only to a long and scuffling future, to mediocrity, not only in his life, but also in his chroniclers, too. Yes, yes, nothing like getting the Three of Pentacles upside down, covering the significator on the second try to send you to the tube to watch a seventh rerun of the Takeshi and Ichizo show, light a cigarette and try to forget the whole thing. To no clear happiness or redeeming cataclysm. All his hopeful cards are reversed. Most unhappily of all, the hanged man, who is supposed to be upside down to begin with, telling of his secret hopes and fears. There never was a Dr. Yamph, opines world-renowned analyst Mickey Wuxtry Wuxtry. Yamph was only a fiction, to help him explain what he felt so terribly, so immediately in his genitals for those rockets each time exploding in the sky, to help him deny what he could not possibly admit, that he might be in love, in sexual love, with his and his race's death. These early Americans, in their way, were a fascinating combination of crude poet and psychic cripple. We were never that concerned with Slothrop qua Slothrop, a spokesman for the counterforce admitted recently in an interview with the Wall Street Journal. Interviewer, you mean, then, that he was more a rallying point? Spokesman, no, not even that. Opinion, even at the start, was divided. It was one of our fatal weaknesses. I'm sure you want to hear about fatal weaknesses. Some called him a pretext. Others felt that he was a genuine point-for-point microcosm. The microcosmists, as you must know from the standard histories, leaped off to an early start. It was a very odd form of heretic chasing, really, across the low countries in the summer. It went on in fields of windmills, marshlands where it was almost too dark to get a decent sight. I recall the time Christian found an old alarm clock and we salvaged the radium to coat our plumb bob strings with. They shone in the twilight. You've seen them holding bobs, hands characteristically gathered near the crotch. A dark figure with a stream of luminescent piss falling to the ground 50 meters away. The presence, pissing, that became a standard joke on the apprentices. A rakhi noble, you might say. Yes, a cute way of putting it. I am betraying them all. The worst of it is that I know what your editors want, exactly what they want. I am a traitor. I carry it with me, your virus, spread by your tireless typhoid Marys, cruising the markets and the stations. We did manage to ambush some of them. Once we caught some in the underground. It was terrible. My first action, my initiation. We chased them down the tunnels. We could feel their fright. When the tunnels branched, we had only acoustics of the underground to go on. Chances were good for getting lost. There was almost no light. The rails gleamed as they do above ground on a rainy night. And the whispers then, the shadows who waited, hunched in angles at the maintenance stations, lying against the tunnel walls, watching the chase. The end is too far, they whispered. Go back. There are no stops on this branch. The trains run and the passengers ride miles of blank mustard walls, but there are no stops. It's a long afternoon run. Two of them got away, but we took the rest. Between two station marks, yellow crayon through the years of grease and passage, 1966 and 1971, I tasted my first blood. Do you want to put this part in? We drank the blood of our enemies. That's why you see Gnostics so hunted. The sacrament of the Eucharist is really drinking the blood of the enemy. The Grail, the Sangreal, is the bloody vehicle. Why else guard it so sacredly? Why should the Black Honor Guard ride half a continent, half a splintering empire, stone night and winter day, if it's only for the touch of sweet lips and a humble bowl? No, it's mortal sin they're carrying. To swallow the enemy down into the slick juicery to be taken in by all the cells. Your officially defined mortal sin, that is, a sin against you, a section of your penal code, though. The true sin was yours, to interdict that union, to draw that line, to keep us worse than enemies who are, after all, caught in the same fields of shit, to keep us strangers. We drank the blood of our enemies, the blood of our friends we cherished. Item S-1706.31, fragment of undershirt, U.S. Navy issue, with brown stain assumed toward running lower left to upper right. Not included in the book of memorabilia is this footnote. The piece of cloth was given to Slothrop by Simon Bodine one night in the Chicago bar. It was a reprise of their first meeting. Bodine, smoldering fat reefer stuck in under the strings at the neck of his guitar, singing mournfully a song that's part Roger Mexico's and part some nameless sailor stuck in wartime San Diego. Last week I threw a pie at someone's mama. Last night I threw a party for my mind. Last thing I knew, that 602 was screaming over my head, or it might have been the 1159. Refrain. Too many chain-link fences in the evening, too many people shivering in the rain. They tell me that you finally got around to have your baby, and it don't look like I'll see your face again. I want to go back north to Humboldt County. Sometimes I think I'll go back east to see my kin. There's times I think I almost could be happy if I knew you thought about me now and then.